And thank you so much for listening to WMNF Tampa, WMNF Tampa Bay, WMNF 88.5 FM. Welcome to the afternoon. This show is called Art in Your Ear. My name is Joellen Schilke. I am the hostess who loves you absolutely the mostest. And we have such a good show today. Such a good show. So much good music. And such good guests. We're going to be talking to some people from Jobsite Theater's newest show, and that is Dr. Ride's American, was it Dr. Ride's American Beach House. So stick with us. I want to let you know that support for WMNF comes from you, our wonderful members, and Gasparilla Music Festival, October 1st through the 3rd at Curtis Hickson Park in downtown Tampa. Artists include Government Mule, Preservation Hall Jazz Band, Keller Williams, Grateful Gospel, and more. More information at GasparillaMusic.com.
Thank you. We're sailing where the seahorse like to sleep.
What a pretty song. That is Vivian Long, Seahorse. And I played that on Tuesday on filled in with the Lulus. I was a Lou. So had to play it again for you, my wonderful listeners. Vivian Long, an Irish artist. The governing body of WMNF, the Nathan B. Stubblefield Foundation, is seeking applications for the board of directors. You may find the application on our website, wmnf.org, in the About section, or call 813-238-8001 and ask to be emailed an application. The deadline to apply is Friday, September 24th at 5 p.m. So that is today. At 5 p.m. If you're thinking about doing it, it's a really great way to be involved with WMNF. It's a wonderful radio station. It would be wonderful to have you be part of it. Support for WMNF also comes from our members, yay, and Rhyming with Miss Ida, specializing in children's rhyming books, such as Poor Old Goat, Sad Little Dog, and more. Details on Miss Ida's children books are at rhymingwithmissida.com. Well, the next song I'm going to play, and then we'll have our guests come in. I heard this song. I have to tell you that I just steal music from everybody here at, or I get inspired. Let's go with get inspired from everybody. There's not a show I turn on at WMNF where there isn't a music that I Shazam or write down or email them about. It's just fantastic. I suggest you listen outside of your comfort zone. You'll find something that you like. The schedule is online at WMNF.org. But anyway, the next song is called Thank You, and I heard it last night on Amanda Doyle's great program, great new music program, especially Thursday nights. If you like new music, is a great night for that. So it's by Charlotte, and I think it's pronounced Adigiri and Bolis Poople, and it's called Thank You, and it is brilliant, and it is sarcastic, and it is wonderful, and I hope you like it. Thank you.
No, thank you. No, 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 really, thank you. Thank you so much for taking the time to tell me this. This is a real eye-opener. Yeah, you're right, this doesn't look good on me. And maybe I should ditch the blonde wig. That's such a good idea. Tell me, what would you like to see me in then?
Couldn't have done this without you and your opinion. Enlighten me with your vision. I count my blessings.
Yes, I prefer my first EP too. Yeah, maybe I should make it less complex. Two projects, one artist, geez. What the hell was I even thinking?
My inspiration comes from you. Oh, what an honor. I am not worthy of your kindness. No well intentions.
Thank you so much for this opportunity. Yeah, this is really good exposure for us. And exposure shouldn't have a price, right? 'Cause money doesn't rhyme with creativity.
Couldn't have done this without you and your opinion. Enlighten me with your vision. I count my blessings.
To my America,
my inspiration comes from you. Oh, what an honor! I am not worthy of your kindness, noble intentions.
Me. I'm so excited. This song again is Thank You. And thank you to Amanda Doyle for turning me onto it. It's just amazing. Thank you, though. Even a true, sincere thank you, not a sarcastic, passive aggressive thank you to Susan Haldeman and Leah Lusciavo for coming in today for Jobsite Theater's Dr. Ride's American Beach House. So thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
And then what I'm going to do is ask you to say your name and then which character you're playing so people can discern between your voices. So, Susan, if you would start.
All right. I'm Susan Haldeman, and I'm playing Meg.
And Meg is, give me a 10-word description of Meg.
Meg is a very secure woman, probably in her mid-40s or so, that sort of comes into the book club that they have because she's been invited by Harriet's best friend, and sort of shakes things up a little bit.
A little bit. And then, Leo, would you tell us a little bit about Harriet?
Sure. I'm Leo Lusciavo, and I play Harriet, who is insecure and figuring out what she wants to do with her life, intellectual, somewhat failed poet, living in St. Louis in 1983 and trying to sort out where she's going to go with her life from this point on.
The interesting thing about this show is that it's on the, it's set in, as he said, 1983, on the cusp of Sally Ride, Dr. Sally Ride's launch into space and the first woman, first American woman in space. And it was interesting because one thing that I have to say that I just adored about the play is to have a play where all of the characters are smart women. Even is it Norma? Mm-hmm. Not the aunt, but the person, Norma. like, you can tell she's pretty insightful.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And she's really smart. She may not be great or pleasant, but she's definitely, she's pretty funny, too.
Deep thinker.
So it was so nice to, like, just sort of let go of that. You know, occasionally there's that little person in the back of your head going, oh, great, another, you know,
right.
Like, oh, another stereotype, but have all smart women in as the characters, and I would assume as the people doing it. Dr. Ride's, I'm not ever going to be able to say this right, I want to say Dream House, that's right, American Beach House. It doesn't happen, I mean, some parts of it happen in Florida in a way, but what happened when you first got the script? Like, had you heard of the show before? Were you aware of it? When you got the script, did you know, like, how did you deal with the characters when you were reading it? I just want to hear a little bit, since I just freshly read it, I want to talk about freshly reading it before talking about performing it.
I had never heard of the show, and I asked Roxanne for the script so that I could just read it, and I was like, oh, this is lovely, and then I read it again, and I was like, okay, and I felt like the more times I read it, the more things that I found in it, but I gravitated toward both Harriet and Meg, but Meg was a more interesting character to me because she was less like me. I felt like I had a lot in common with Harriet, like a lot of the stuff that has gone on in her past and stuff seemed very similar. And I was like, I don't know if I want to like play something that I'm that close to, or if I want to try to challenge myself and do something very different. So I was really kind of pushing to play Meg.
You didn't want to get away from the get away from safe. I want to mention Roxanne. It was Roxanne Fay, amazing director who directed the show. And then Leah, what about Harriet when you met her, and what about reading the script?
Yeah, well, my first exposure to the script was through auditions when we had sides to read while we were auditioning for, I felt like Roxanne read me for every part, she read a lot of us for every part, so I had no idea where it was going, and then had the opportunity to read the script after being cast, and it's a new script. It's only been produced in New York once before in 2019. Liza Birkenmeier is the playwright, and so this is the second time it's being performed, I believe, certainly outside of New York. So that's very exciting. It's very new. So no, I had not heard of it before, but I did a lot of just online searches and read reviews of that production. But encountering these women, as you said, they are not only extremely intelligent, but very multidimensional. There are so many facets of their personalities that, as actresses, it's a gift to be able to really delve into who these women are. And yeah, I felt very in tune with Harriet. There's a lot in her that is relatable and... again, to my personal life, and the use of language is just beautifully done. It's conversational, it's informal, but it's still very targeted and precise. And both Matilda and Harriet are poets, and that's clear in the way that they communicate with each other and communicate with the world.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I want to ask you, hasn't the playwright been here while you're working on it?
She has not been here, physically here, but I know Roxanne and our dramaturg, Tatiana, have had many conversations with her. And she will be here.
Yeah, she's coming on her first and second preview, both? I know she's coming.
One or the other,
previews.
We're trying to ignore that. No offense to Liza.
She's not coming because, well, that's...
She's not coming. She's not going to be in the room. That's someone that looks a lot like her, but not her. I hear you on that. So one of the things, and then you talked about Harriet being a failed poet, even though her job is... sort of working within poetry, but is she a failed poet, or does she just think she's a failed poet?
At this point, she thinks she is.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's because that's what I want to sort of get into a little bit with you all about how the characters and how, of course, as artists that you portray this, how the characters think about themselves and how they think about each other, and then showing that. I know it's easy to say, well, the words are on the page, but this script has, to me, was so open for interpretation. It was just wide, wide open. So I want to, if you would talk a little bit about some of the intent and what you're doing and trying to, display things. I mean, certainly Meg is in a way, a chaos agent for the show, and a delightful chaos agent. I mean, chaos might be strong, but she has that sense of chaos that she brings into it. And then Harriet is so restless, it seems. So will you talk a little bit about communicating that to each other and to the audience, and as artists, how you all work together to sort of develop that for the audience? Just a small question.
No levels to that. Well, I think Meg she's at a crossroads in her life. I think all of these characters, except maybe Norma, are at a crossroads. So they, when they come together, it is probably both a little confusing and probably good for them to know that they're not the only one. But Meg is just, she's at a point in her life where I think she knows who she is. So she's confident in that. And I think that is part of what stirs everything up, because you've got two people who are maybe just a little younger, just still a little bit in flux in their lives, and then she is inserted into this place, and she's not questioning who she is. She's questioning where she is in her life, but not who she is.
So I'm going to, when reading about you guys before that, it seems... that maybe there's a little resonance in your life on this. Perhaps.
Yeah, a little. I am not as secure as that character, as Meg is in herself. So that's part of why I wanted to play it, because that, you know, you can't help but play something and have it bleed over into your life a little bit. And I was like, I want to play somebody who's that secure in who they are, because I want to feel that. Mm-hmm. And I've kind of based her on, I won't say who it is, but I've kind of based her on a member of our arts community here that I think of as that, just mm-hmm. very intelligent, very well-spoken, and very secure in who she is.
I can think of like 4 people. That's awesome.
I'm sure it's one of them.
Yeah. So then, now this is great, because I don't have a chance to ask that a lot about actors. Are there roots then when part of wanting to play a character is to sort of experience a quality that you wish you had more of or a different type of? How, like, can you, as actors, is it safe? Is it smart? Is it bad to then try to create those roots in you of that characteristic?
I think that most, at least for me, most characters that I end up wanting to play, I've already got something in me that I'm rooted in with them. Mm-hmm. If I don't have that, I have to find it. I have to figure out where that is in me, because mm-hmm. I feel like every character has something that you can latch on to. You just have to find it. It's a little harder to find it with some characters.
I always kind of wonder. When I was in college and high school, I did acting. Of course, much like music, I really appreciate acting, and it's terrible that I have zero talent for it. But that was kind of a really big disappointment in my life, the complete lack of talent for doing those things. But the thing that was so interesting to me was that, and the first big role I ever had was Midsummer Night's Dream. I was Tatiana, you know. So, and she was so strong and powerful. And at the time, I did not feel strong and powerful. I had been sexually assaulted. I had, you know, been, people had told me that I was overreacting. You know, I mean, it was really terrible. And so I didn't feel I had power. But her power was something that I would cling to and use, not just in rehearsals and not just when I was trying to learn the script. So I'm kind of curious, and this is a sideways, but you brought it up. how can you do that? Do actors do that? Can you, when you need it outside of playing a role, when you need that confidence or you need something from your person that you have played, can you draw on that? Or is that, once the play is over, it's not there anymore?
Oh, they stick with you. I mean, especially if you have a character that you resonate with deeply. For whatever reason, I was going to bring up the point that sometimes in the process of casting, a director can see something in you that you didn't know. And that's been interesting in different roles I've played in my life. I've been cast in parts that initially I was like, this isn't me at all. And then through the process of rehearsal, you know, that person comes to life within you. And I've learned a lot from the people I've played in the past, and strength and confidence and overcoming anxiety, which I have and deal with all the time. You know, just forcing yourself into that place, there's always rewards at the end of that.
Is it, was it ever like a unpleasant surprise? Be like, oh, I had that in me, like, woo.
Sometimes. Yeah. Sometimes. It depends on the character. I mean, right. There's villains out there, and if you're playing that villain, you have to understand why you're doing that and why they're doing that and where that comes from and where those impulses are and the justifications that go on within that person to validate whatever actions they are, especially if it's not somebody that you as yourself know or admire or, you know.
Right. That was Leah Lusciavo, and also here is Susan Handelman. We're talking about their characters in a Job Site Theater production, which is going to be opening, Dr. Ride's American Beach House. And so with these characters and getting to know them and playing them, you have Meg, who kind of shows up a little less, you know, midway through or so. She's showing up into an established relationship. And that seems, you know, there's all sorts of things. Will you talk a little bit about, we have, of course, the missing person, Matilda. Will you talk a little bit about that triangle and what you all wanted to do with it? Because it felt the good part that I really, one of the many good things I liked about this play is that triangle kept on sort of reshaping itself, mm-hmm. that it was not, you know, equidistant and static. So will you talk a little bit about how your characters regard each other and what everybody kind of wants out of that night, you know,
right.
either coming in or maybe eventually.
Right. Mm-hmm. I think Meg has somehow met Matilda. There are a lot of things about Meg in this script that are very open-ended, and you have no idea, like, how this happened, so you have to make them up in your head. I've decided that because she works across the street at the hospital, Matilda has come in there, and they've probably met at, like, a coffee bar that's mm-hmm. in there or something like that, and Matilda is very outgoing and is probably like, hey,
is
what
she
do
seductive?
You
do? Is your Matilda seductive?
Yeah, I think, like, she's a person that everybody's attracted to. I mean, I think they say that in the script. She's mm-hmm. just one of those people that, like, she's the life of the party and you mm-hmm. want to know her.
She's a Leo.
Yeah.
referenced many times. Yes. Self-referenced, too, yeah. which is pretty in keeping.
Yes, it is.
Yeah, she's Leo. Like a ray of light. People are attracted to her. Mm-hmm. She has a natural charisma.
Right, but there's charisma and there's also seductiveness.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I'm really curious about that because there was things in the script where it wasn't necessarily seductiveness, that there is lust in the script mm-hmm. and there is hidden lust, I think, in the script, which, mm-hmm. But there's also being seductive to people is one type of charisma, and mm-hmm. but there's a right. little bit maybe more purposeful, like seduction is a little more purposeful than charisma, maybe?
Yeah. We've talked... about at least, I mean, a little bit about, you know, what sort of attracts Meg to this, you know, this thing. I do think she's, I don't know that she's attracted to Matilda, but I do think that, like, she gets into the situation and I think that Meg is inherently a flirt and I think Matilda is too. So I think that probably started some of it. But I think that Meg being comfortable and, you know, being a lesbian and walking into this situation of two people who are at these very interesting crossroads, and there's that undercurrent of, you know, what is their sexual undertone, like what's happening here. So I think, like, that security probably that they both have but in very different ways attracted them to each other. And then she was like, this girl's interesting. Yes, I'm going to go to whatever this book club is.
Right, yeah.
And then she shows up and there's two people there.
And no books.
Right.
And no books. I don't think that's a giveaway. Yeah. No books.
No.
Certainly no discussion of books.
Yeah. Right, no. No.
And then she just finds herself drawn to Harriet.
Right. And so let's. How did you find Harriet? Like, was it... You know, was she initially pretty easy to read? Like, okay, I get this character, or was it something that you had to, like, oh, wait, maybe Harriet isn't who I think it is? Talk a little bit about building or creating or finding. I'm not sure what the right words are, sculpting.
Creating, yeah. You know, initially, what resonated with me the most was her love of language and poetry and that aspect of her and her... I mean, it's described as a failure to launch, but like she's holding on to something at this point in her life. There's reticence and some fear, but we talk about being hungry a lot in the script, and that little notes like that started to pop out at me because even though she's been this kind of mousy, in those shadows person as the opposite of Matilda's extroverted nature, Harriet is very much more of an introvert. She has this huge desire to break out of that. And what we're seeing in this evening is all this stuff that's been wanting to come out of her. It's probably been in her poetry, but now it's coming out of who she is because of a series of circumstances that have happened in her life very recently that unfold in the course of the play. So something else I found fun about her, it's finding her humor. That didn't come out for me until I was like really deeply invested in it. in the words in the script. And so, yeah, I mean, it's just a layering. I mean, I've read the script so many times now, and every time I read it, there's another thing that jumps out at
me.
Well,
it's fun because it starts off with basically they're spying on people, you know.
right.
They're looking into people's, they're on their roof, and they're looking into other people's apartments and spying and actively. Like, this is clearly not the first time they've ever done it, you know.
That's a regular activity.
That's what they do at the book club.
Yeah. Right. They don't have smartphones. They have binoculars.
Right, exactly. So, but that also, like, the way the conversation surrounding, you know, looking at these other people's lives, and then later there's sort of like, well, is this, what is my life? You know, I mean, there's a point where Harriet is describing something that she did that to her seems so far out of character. Mm-hmm. And the circumstances were just so intense and all that. And it just seems like everybody else is like, yeah, we know. Like, we know that this is, yeah, that was crazy, but yeah, it's time for you to do that. And that was something else I liked a lot about the script is that, again, not women, I mean, even scripts by women sometimes, to me, have too much of the, we are going to be, you know, oppositional.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's not an oppositional script. It's a lovely script. And I went back and looked at all these things about Sally Ride and her relationships and the beach house, and I wanted barbecue and all that type of stuff. So there is a lot of food in it and drinking. So when you guys are there talking about the characters and their development and their stuff. And there's very much, you know, that Meg comes up and I think there's something where is she wearing her uniform when she comes in?
Yeah.
And then she kind of transforms into that. Is there desire between everybody? I mean, because I was kind of wondering, is there desire between Harriet and Matilda, is their desire, you know, the cross currents of desire. Mm-hmm. Was that something that you guys had to really focus on in addition to the script? Did the script give you the right level of how you wanted to play it or not play it?
I think, for me at least, I had read the script several times, but I didn't understand the relationships until I heard it, until I saw it. And now every time I hear it and see it, it's new stuff coming up. So that's really cool. But this script is all, to me, about connection. So it's all about, you know, Harriet and Matilda's connection to each other and what that is and how that has developed over the years. And then Meg coming in and connecting with these two people and what she can bring to this situation. And even with Norma, like her connection to Harriet and how they're a little kind of mother-daughter type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just all of these connections. And then our, you know, everybody with Sally Ride and how they connect to what's going on there. And so it's just a very, there's all this connective tissue in it. And like you said, no one is mean or judgy, or it's just,
funny.
Very intelligent, very funny, well-spoken women, you know.
Well, when I was talking about desire, it's not just sexual desire and attractive, but, you know, they want more beer. They want a big glass of wine. They want more food. They want to go do something. They want to change something. Like, there's
desire on multiple levels.
Right, and even there's a boyfriend, but he's not really, he's just not good enough, you know. There's a child, but do I really have to go deal with her? You know, like, it's just this sort of, like, no, this, I'm not fulfilled, and I want to be fulfilled. And I think that speaks to a lot of people, of course, today, but I think it's especially
at
the last
time.
Few, at that time, but also now, you know, if you think, there's a lot of stuff about where we're not fulfilled because we have to hit all these marks for our daily living. Harriet has to work on this guy's, who's a real person, this guy's old poems, or, you know, you know, like this riverboat poems, and she's in a riverboat situation. I don't quite understand that part, but, you know, but there's sort of this, like, I want something else and this isn't it, you know?
Right.
And that is something that I think will speak a lot to the audience about it.
Yeah.
How about 1983, going back to 1983, were there things that you sort of had to unremember or block out in this time travel?
Well, I was alive then, but I was six.
I was 10. So.
Right. I actually went back and looked at a lot of old commercials and found footage around St. Louis from the, or not only the early 80s, but the 70s. I wanted to have just like images in my mind of what Harriet was looking at her point in her life, which is mid-30s. But what she grew up with, I mean, we went back to the 60s and 50s just to have some context of what that was like. It wasn't about unremembering, but it was more about building that life.
Can you do the accent?
Oh, no. That's something we kind of stepped away from.
Right.
Yeah. Because it felt more, I guess, probably distracting.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know if unremember is the right
okay,
word.
Okay, yeah, it's no, just, that might be, you know.
Yeah, I was trying to more to have a content, an adult perspective of the era and the time. But yeah, listening to the radio, listening, or radio commercials, TV commercials. I watched Ordinary People and the Thornbirds and, you know, just I wanted to see and feel what it looked like.
Right, what their reality would be.
Yeah. Right, right, right. And what the pop culture was like, you know, what was mainstream culture that they probably weren't a huge part of, you know, but it's still around you. It's the sea you swim in. So that was kind of part of my process.
Yeah.
Same.
I did a lot of like thinking about and looking at like gay culture in the 80s because as a gay woman, you don't hear a lot about gay women in the 80s because of the AIDS epidemic going on. And there's a lot of information about that. And there's a lot of information about being an ally and, you know, helping with all of that. But there isn't a lot of information about, like, just what the female gay culture was. Mm-hmm. So I found it really interesting that even then when it wasn't, you know, as acceptable, and I mean, I don't know what it was like in St. Louis, but it wasn't as acceptable to be gay, and I don't know how acceptable it was to be a lesbian. And she's so, like, just seems very out and proud and comfortable with who she is, and I find that really interesting in that time period.
Right, that it has more of a, you know, I mean, because even today there are people who are in circumstances where it isn't comfortable to be just very proudly gay or proudly trans or proudly, you know, anything, because there might be people in their life that will make it very difficult, you know, and that's now almost 40 years later.
Absolutely. So. And now it's supposedly so, you know, quote unquote mainstream.
Right.
But, you know, it's
not true for everyone.
It depends on what corner you've just crossed, you know, like who you're going to walk by on the sidewalk.
I have friends here whose parents still don't know that they're gay.
Yeah.
And these are men in their 50s, you know, and it's just, it was their culture is just not going to accept it. And that is, that just to me sounds really hard, like a really difficult way to have to do things, but that's what they need to do. We're really kind of out of time. And I have like 20 more questions for you all. So I'm kind of wondering, and I don't, of course, we're not going to give away anything about the ending, but I wonder if you all had to sort of to do the ending, if you had to imagine kind of something happening afterwards, because it is really sort of very open at the end and fun. And it seems like, is there going to be a next season? Like, is this a prequel?
Right.
I mean, is this, because I want to see this potential adventure going on. But how do you, as generally as actors, how do you sort of understand endings? And then specifically for this show, did you all have to, you know, create something to make you understand the ending, like to embed the ending inside you?
In this context, the character is experiencing something that will be wide open. So that's where I leave it. To imagine beyond that would invest something in her that just isn't there yet. Mm-hmm. You know, it's finally a launch. Mm-hmm. And what's on the other side of that, she doesn't know. So I can't know.
Mm-hmm. It seemed, though, that would be gratifying as an artist to know that your character will have this sort of like well, what's coming up next?
Yeah.
You know, like to have that unknowing is exciting.
It is.
I think.
Yeah.
So, and what about our friend Meg?
Yeah, I think she's, strangely, they find themselves in a similar situation there where they, you know, it's, she's going to be in a whole new phase of her life and we'll see what happens. But I've tried not to read into it so that I, you know, it's a surprise to me.
Mm-hmm. It's a surprise. It'll be a surprise to her, hopefully. Mm-hmm. Well, so do you all have anything coming up that you want to mention before we get out of here?
Yes, one of our, we wanted to bring up that one of the shows, the one on October 3rd, our matinee, is actually a Pride event, and we'll have LGBTQ groups in the community there tabling in the lobby, and there's a talk back after the show, and there is a special discount for that show as well, which you can find out about by going to jobsitetheater.org.
Excellent. And then, Susan, do you have anything you want to mention?
That's pretty much it. I don't really have any cool projects coming up,
but I
create wigs and I'm designing wigs for Urbanite Theater right now, so.
I saw that. You know, I had this young woman who always hung out when I had a coffee shop, got a job 9 years later, creating wigs for the Metropolitan Opera.
Oh, wow.
And I didn't know, but when she got the job, I would look into all that stuff, and it was amazing and so interesting and so fabulous. So the show opens on Wednesday, is a preview, the 29th of, does that sound right?
The 29th, Wednesday the 29th is a preview. The 30th is a preview.
And then it opens on Friday the 1st and then runs for 2 weeks.
Two
weeks only. So it's get in there and see it. And I'm looking forward to seeing it as well in person to see you all. Wasn't there something at Tampa Theater you wanted to mention? I've got it up here I can talk about, but if you want to mention it.
Yeah, well, in addition to being an actor, I work at Tampa Theater, and we have our Nightmare on Franklin Street event coming up late October. Several screenings of scary movies, including Nosferatu at the Wurlitzer Organ. There's ghost tours, Rocky Horror Picture Show, all kinds of fun
Plan
events.
Plan 9 from Outer Space.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my God.
There's really great stuff coming up. So check out tampatheater.org
Right. So it starts Saturday the 16th and goes through. That's wonderful. Well, thank you all so much for coming in. I really appreciate it. It was lovely to see you. And we're going to go out with Janelle Monáe's song, Sally Ride, here on Art in Your Ear on WMNF. If you want more information about Dr. Ride's American Beach House, you can go online to jobsitetheater.org. And then it's right there in the front. It's really hard to kind of miss it. So, and it is at the Straz Center in which?
The Jabe Theater.
In the Jabe Theater.
Yep, so, socially distanced.
Right. It's a great space to see theater because it has so much that you can do with the space in there. So it's a wonderful thing. Well, thank you both so much for coming in. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
So here we have Janelle Monáe with Sally Ride.
is a WMNF public service announcement. The Glazer Children's Museum is celebrating its 11th birthday at Birthday Bash on September 25th in Curtis Hickson Waterfront Park. There are live performances, special guests, classic field day games, and complimentary museum admission. This family-friendly celebration is primarily outdoors and socially distanced. More at glazermuseum.org.
Yes, and there you go. You know, I was looking for some promos for cross-promoing, I can't even speak today, some other shows, but I'll just speak my promos for you. Let's put some music on in the background. There we go. No, doesn't want to work. There we go. Coming up right after this show is the NPR News, and I see E-Love in the studio getting ready for a fantastic show for you. She plays global electronica and does just this wonderful beginning of the weekend type show. After that is a live music showcase. I believe they will have an artist on the live music showcase. I see Mark here doing stuff like that. After the, so that's at 2 o'clock at 3 till 6 p.m. on WMNF, we've got the Reverend Billy and Marvelous Marv do the Rhythm Revival. It is a reach back, not all, but mainly older music, the roots of rock and roll on the airwaves. And then from 6 to 8 p.m., of course, we have the fantastic Soul Party, classic R&B and soul with Steve the Hitman. At 8 to 10 o'clock is just a delightful melange of music from Da Soul Kitchen. It's got soul, it's got hip-hop, it's got classic R&B, it's got always a surprise. And then we end our Friday nights with Flashback Friday, and that is really reaching in to deep Florida R&B, Florida soul, and just really fun music. It's definitely the most late night of all the late night shows that we have, if that's possible. So, let's see, what else do I have? There was something else. Well, we kind of talked about stuff. I do have a song I want to play next. It is from Big Joe Turner, and I'm playing it because one of my favorite shows on the air is on Monday nights. It used to be on Fridays. It's on Monday nights from 9 to 11 o'clock, and this fantastic show is... here we go. This fantastic show is called Route 66, and it's Jump, Jive, and Swing. So I'm going to play some Big Joe Turner for the DJ Mike Vinyl. Here is Big Joe Turner with Flip, Flop, and Fly.
Now when I get the blues, I get me a rocking chair. When I get the blues, I get me a rocking chair. Well, the blues overtake me, gonna rock right away from here. Now when I get lonesome, I jump on the telephone. When I get lonesome, I jump on the telephone. I call my baby, tell him on my way back home. Now flip, flop, and fly, I don't care if I die. Now flip, flop, and fly, I don't care if I die. Don't ever leave me, don't ever say goodbye. Give me one more kiss, hold it a long, long time. Give me one more kiss, hold it a long, long time. Now love me, baby, to the feeling hits my head like wine. Here comes my baby, flashing a new gold tooth. Here comes my baby, flashing a new gold tooth. Well, she's so small, she can mumble in a payphone booth. Now flip, flop, and fly, I don't care if I die. Now flip, flop, and fly, I don't care if I die. Don't ever leave me, don't ever say goodbye. Mississippi bulldog sitting on a hollow stump. I got so many women, I don't know what you way to jump. Now flip, flop, and fly. I don't care if I die. Now flip, flop, and fly. I don't care if I die. Now don't ever leave me. Don't ever say goodbye. Oh my.
Well, thanks everybody for listening. It'll be a delight to talk to you next week and talk with you. Thanks for the emails. Thank you so much. Please stay tuned for NPR News, followed, of course, by the wonderful ultrasounds with E-Love. My name is Joellen Chilke. I am the hostess who loves you the most. I'm so excited you got to tune in today. This show is called Art and Era. You've been listening to WMNF.org, WMNF Tampa, 88.5 FM. We're going to go out with Aline. It's Jarvis Cocker's new song. It's a cover of an old French song, and it is a promo for the new Wes Anderson movie, The Latest Dispatch. Is that what? The French Dispatch. So thanks for listening. Talk to you next week. Oh, wait, I'm going to be here on Monday filling in for Flea. So please tune in from noon to 3. And I'll play you some music. Bye.
S'était enfoui. Je l'ai cherché.